pioneer. I'm an explorer. I'm a human, and I'm coming. I'm animated. I'm alive. My heart's big. It's got hot blood going through it fast. I like to fight, too. I like to eat. I like to have children. I got a life force. This is a human. This is what we look like. This is what we act like. This is what I am. I'm a throwback. I'm here. I've got the fire of human liberty. I'm setting fires everywhere, and humans are turning on everywhere.
Wow. Just a typical day on InfoWars, the ultra-far-right radio show hosted by Alex Jones. Jones is known for his anger and for spouting vile conspiracy theories, but new court documents from his lawyers claim that the whole thing is just an elaborate performance. We'll have more on that later. First, though, the first Dreamer has been deported under the Trump administration. That's according to a lawsuit filed in San Diego on behalf of Juan Manuel Montes, who was brought to the United States from Mexico when he was just 9 years old. Montes has DACA status. That's the Obama-era program that protects undocumented people brought to the U.S. as children. But he was picked up by border agents in Calexico back in February and deported when he wasn't able to produce his ID. The Trump administration has said it will leave DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, intact for now. But with the deportation of Montes, there are new questions about the future of the program. Nora Preciado is the lead attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, and she represents Montes in this case. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, so let's just get the story from you. He left his wallet in a car when he was visiting friends in Calexico, and then he was stopped by Border Patrol agents, right? And he couldn't produce his ID. And then what happened?
He was taken to what we believe to be the port of entry in Calexico, detained for a couple of hours. And then this is where the black hole of information is. The government deported him without access to an attorney, without an explanation as to why, without any documents showing him what had happened to him, and despite the fact that Juan Manuel had DACA, and that meant that he had a work authorization allowing him to work in the country until at least 2018, and despite all of that, he was deported.
Didn't he sign papers basically agreeing to be deported? That's at least what the government says.
Unfortunately, the government has not provided us with any documentation or any additional information. That's what this lawsuit is about. For weeks now, we have attempted in numerous ways to get information and documents about what happened to Juan Manuel from Border Patrol, CBP, USCIS, without any success. And that's why we had to file this lawsuit, just to find out what happened to Juan Manuel.
So authorities are saying, though, that he went to Mexico without letting them know. And he's supposed to do that, right? If he has DACA, he's supposed to sign in or let them know when he leaves the country?
So DHS's story keeps changing. Yesterday was that Juan Manuel didn't have DACA. Now it's that he had abandoned that voluntarily. However, our client, Juan Manuel, has been unequivocal about the fact that he never voluntarily left the country while he had DACA. He knew two things for sure. He knew he had permission to work in the U.S., and he knew he couldn't leave the country without asking for permission. And so we know that that didn't happen. The statement by DHS doesn't provide any additional information or anything else. And like I said, while they're talking to the media, we have yet to receive any documents or any information about our client and what happened to him.
So what they're also saying to the media is that he returned to the United States or tried to by hopping a fence.
The government is conveniently focusing on his second deportation. Juan Manuel was deported after the encounter with Border Patrol in a matter of hours, the first time, without an explanation, without a lawyer, without any documents, without any due process. Once he was in Mexicali, in Mexico, after he was deported, he was mugged and beaten by two individuals at knife point. They took his belongings that friends had brought him over to Mexico, and he was scared. He was scared for his life. All he could think about doing was coming back home. And so he saw somebody jump the fence, and that's what he did. But he turned himself into authorities because he feared for his life. Mm-hmm. And that's the beginning of the second deportation of Juan Manuel. Again, this time he was held for approximately 16 hours, we believe. And again, no access to an attorney, no documents about what happened to him, no explanation, and he was deported a second time. The government is conveniently choosing to focus only on that deportation and refusing to even acknowledge that the first one happened.
But then does that act, does that complicate your case when it comes to the first deportation, that he committed this illegal act of coming over illegally?
The first step in this lawsuit is precisely why we're in federal court. We just don't have the information and documents about what happened to our client to even be able to tell him what his legal options are. The government has adamantly refused for weeks now to provide us any information or any documentation, again, despite repeated attempts. That's what this lawsuit is about. Juan Manuel wants answers. He wants to know what happened to him. He doesn't even know to this day why he was deported or how this could have happened to him.
So what is he doing now? Where is he?
He is in Mexico with relatives and, very eager to come home. He misses home. This is the place he knows is his home. He's been here since he was 9 years old. He was going to school. He was working in the fields to help pay for school, hanging out with friends, just being a normal 23-year-old. And that's what he wants most. He just wants to come home.
Let me play a clip of tape of President Trump when he was asked about DACA back in February.
DACA is a very, very difficult subject for me, I will tell you. To me, it's one of the most difficult subjects I have because you have these incredible kids in many cases, not in all cases. In some of the cases, they're having DACA and they're gang members and they're drug dealers, too. But you have some absolutely incredible kids, I would say mostly.
Okay. And so he said he wanted to keep the DACA program intact for now. Let me get some information from you in terms of the legality of when you're eligible for DACA or not if you've committed a crime. He said there some of them are gang members and drug dealers. Does that make them ineligible for DACA?
The department, USCIS, has been very clear from the beginning about what types of encounters with law enforcement disqualify somebody from DACA. From the beginning, they've been clear about that. And we know that there is nothing in Juan Manuel's record that would disqualify him for that program, which is what makes this very puzzling. Mm-hmm. And again, without any information about what happened to him or why, it's hard to determine, what the government's excuse for what happened to him will be tomorrow, since it keeps changing. I think there's a certain hypocrisy that we're seeing from this administration, on the one hand saying that, DACA kids shouldn't be fearing deportation, and then you have a case like Juan Manuel's where everything that he was promised, that he could be in the country and work and not fear deportation for 2 years, that promise was broken. And so I think it's time for the government to really just take stock of what they're doing and match that to the words that they're saying and show some accountability.
So given what you just said, what are you recommending to other people who have DACA status? What should they be doing in light of this case?
I think since the election, DACA recipients have been in an uncertain sort of limbo. They know that for now they are protected and that they should be protected. And Juan Manuel's case is an extreme. We do know that other DACA recipients have been detained, and we just need some clarity. I think those young people deserve some clarity so that they, again, like Juan Manuel just wants to do, can continue with their lives and continue going to school, working, thriving in life without having to fear deportation.
But should they renew their status if they need to or not?
That's been a really personal decision that I think every DACA recipient is making on their own, hopefully with the assistance of attorneys who can advise them of their legal options and the risks or not that they face in doing so. I think, DACA recipients continue to apply for renewal. Many choose not to, but again, that's a personal decision best discussed with an attorney so that they know exactly what their benefits and risks may be.
Nora Preciado is a staff attorney at the National Immigration Law Center in Los Angeles. She's representing Juan Manuel Montes in his suit against the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a dreamer? Are you worried about renewing your status? Are you taking any new precautions under this new administration. You can comment on our Facebook page or on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, Ivanka Trump's business in China and how that may be an ethical minefield and why retail is having a terrible year. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. President Donald Trump signed his Buy American, Hire American executive order yesterday, all while his daughter Ivanka keeps building a fashion empire overseas. China approved three new trademarks for her brand, called Ivanka Trump, earlier this month. Japan approved trademarks in February. They're for clothes, shoes, handbags. Meanwhile, Ivanka's expanded her official role in her father's White House. She has not completely extricated herself from her business. And here to talk about this conflict of interest is Rachel Abrams, business reporter for The New York Times. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, how much is her company worth?
It's hard to know because it's privately held, meaning they are not required to release their financial figures publicly. But we do know from some recent disclosures that Jared Kushner made, that's her husband, mm-hmm. who's also a federal employee, he released some financial information that had some info about her on it. And one of the things we learned is that the trust that holds her brand, they are valuing that at over $50 million. We don't know sort of what that means exactly, but we do know that she's got shoes, handbags, clothing, all of that is sold throughout the country, including at Macy's, which is the country's largest department store. So she's certainly got a presence.
Well, okay, so before we go overseas, domestically, though, she's had some trouble. Didn't Nordstrom drop her brand?
Yeah, and it's, again, this is really hard to measure because on the one hand, you see that Nordstrom has dropped her brand. You know that other companies, other retailers have gotten really nervous because of some of the inflammatory remarks that her father has made. Retailers, especially department stores, they're not really doing that well these days. They can't afford to have these sort of mass boycotts that have been, there's one actually major boycott against Ivanka Trump's products called Grab Your Wallet that's really mobilized a lot of people to stop shopping at Nordstrom and other stores that sell her lines of clothes and handbags, et cetera. And department stores are not in a position to continue selling stuff that is creating such a backlash. What Nordstrom said and what Neiman Marcus said is that, because Neiman Marcus also stopped selling her jewelry, they said, look, sales weren't that great. And you have to think that if sales aren't that great and you're also generating a lot of bad publicity, this isn't going to be worth it for department stores that are already struggling to stay open.
But it's another story in China, right, where there's this thing now called Ivanka mania.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they so into her there?
She's really seen as sort of like a real symbol of American aspiration, very glamorous. She certainly has this kind of stereotypical sort of look of success to her. She's modeled in her own advertisements for her own brand. So, you know, I think that she, perhaps even more so overseas, really represents a certain kind of glamour and luxury.
So then she gets these trademarks from China, three trademarks, literally on the day that she met with the Chinese Premier Xi at mm-hmm. Mar-a-Lago. Does that not represent some glaring conflict of interest?
Ethics experts would say, yeah, totally. I mean, look, did they sit in that room and when they have North Korea to talk about, did they talk about, you know, hey, Ivanka, by the way, has got some stuff held up at your trademark office? Who knows, right? I mean, they certainly have a lot of stuff to talk about, and that seems like pretty low priority in terms of what the White House needs to talk to China about. But at the very least, you have to think that it doesn't look great to have this kind of happen at the same time. And what it really says is that it's really difficult for this administration to untangle itself from its business interests. And that even if Ivanka is not running the day-to-day operations of her company, she has handed over that role to her, the president of her brand, this stuff is still happening around her and it still could create the appearance of that what she's doing is self-serving.
And even if she's not running things, is she still making money from it?
Absolutely. And that's another problem. She still receives regular financial reports from her brand. She still receives money from her brand. I don't know exactly how the payments work, but before the election, she owned her brand 100% outright. I have no reason to believe that that's changed. So just because it's in a trust doesn't mean that she's not still making money off of it. What's sort of most concerning to ethics experts, frankly, is that she can still veto potential deals that her brand makes. She is still able to say, you know, look, I'm doing this thing in the White House, and this thing my brand wants to do is a could be a potential conflict, so we're not going to do that deal. Or what she can say is, you know what, I'm going to recuse myself from business in the White House, and I'm going to, you know, so that in order so that my brand can do some deal. And that, on the one hand, that might be a way to manage your conflicts, but on the other hand, that might be sort of alarming to people that think, you know, there should really be more of a separation here.
So this is an ethical quandary, right? And people are really, you know, disturbed over it. Ethics experts are disturbed over everything you've just said. But is there anything technically illegal about what she's doing?
One of the most problematic things does not have to do with her brand. It has to do with her stake in the old post office. Some legal experts have argued that the emoluments clause in the Constitution, which bars federal employees from making money off of foreign governments, that she could be running afoul of that by making money off of the old post office.
This is the Trump Hotel.
Yes, I'm sorry. This is the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., that federal ethics experts are concerned that because she maintains a financial stake in that, and that is a hotel where potentially foreign businesses or heads of state could stay in order to curry favor with the White House, that could be problematic. And that doesn't necessarily have to do with her brand. But when it comes to her brand, now that she's an official employee, she is barred by ethics rules from doing anything in the White House that could enrich her personal businesses. So she's basically navigating a minefield of potential conflicts, because arguably a lot of the stuff that the president has put on the top of his agenda could potentially influence her or her husband's various business interests.
But so even sitting next to Xi while getting a trademark from China or having business in China, is that in and of itself an ethics violation? Because just her very presence could be seen as benefiting her company. Just having a conversation with him could be seen as benefiting her company. I mean, you know, as you said earlier, the officials in China, they see that photo op of the two of them together, and they're going to say, okay, yeah, here's your trademark.
I would say that what I've heard generally is that the people that say that she could be crossing a legal line if she did X, X is usually a very specific way that she's trying to influence her business. Now, again, if she were sitting in that meeting and not talking about her brand, and some foreign official in China thought, oh, well, I should really approve this thing now because clearly she's in with my boss, obviously that's problematic. Is it illegal? I haven't heard anybody make that case.
So let's say she is running afoul of ethics rules. What are the repercussions?
This is new, uncharted territory. We don't understand who's supposed to enforce, say, the emoluments clause. We've never had to deal with a president or his kids potentially violating the emoluments clause. I mean, who's supposed to enforce it? Is it supposed to be a special prosecutor? Is it supposed to be the DOJ? I mean, this is stuff that's being figured out right now. So in terms of her violating federal ethics rules, I am not aware of exactly how that gets handled, but I don't think this is territory that we've really dealt with. We have had a lot of experience with in the past. I mean, there are a lot of people who are making noise about the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., but it's sort of unclear to me what the repercussions of that are going to be.
Rachel Abrams is a business reporter with The New York Times. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
Well, Ivanka's clothing line could be facing bigger problems than a brand boycott in the near future. And that's because America is in the middle of a major upheaval in retail. 10 retailers have filed for bankruptcy so far this year, including BCBG, Payless, and Wet Seal. That's more than in all of 2016. Other major brands like Sears and Macy's are closing a bunch of stores this year. And last month alone, just in one month, more than 30,000 people lost their retail jobs. Joining us to talk about all this is Ron Friedman. He's an LA-based retail expert with the accounting and advisory firm Marcum. Hi, Ron.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing great. Why are we seeing all these store closings? Is this all because we're shopping online? It's all Amazon's fault?
I think a portion of it is Amazon's fault because Amazon, as you know, we all use Amazon. But I also think it's a function of, in this country, we have over 26 square feet per person of retail space. Yeah. When you look at other countries like Japan and Europe, they will be, you know, 6 square feet per for each retailer. So there's much more square footage in this country, and that's a problem.
Well, was that square footage once filled and filled by prospering companies?
It was. And now we have everyone going online, and more people want to shop online. Also, we're facing a situation where the millennial want to basically shop online, and they want to go out for an experience. They're not interested in going to retail stores.
Well, what about stores like J.Crew or Anthropologie or The Gap that have an online presence? Can they survive?
They're going to have to lower their footprint on their retail brick-and-mortar stores and have less square footage, and that's how they're going to survive. They also have to create an environment where someone wants to come in the store. And you're going to find retail stores creating more restaurants, cafes, social environments where people can come, sit down, relax, and maybe they'll do some shopping. But it's an experience today. And it's not just about going to a store to buy, because people can do it online.
Right. So does that mean places like The Grove or the Americana, they do well because they do provide an experience?
Correct. And that's why you're seeing many malls being remodeled. And what you're seeing is the brick-and-mortar retailers are leaving, and more restaurants and service locations are coming to the malls. So it'll be a different type of experience. And we're seeing that in the Topanga Mall that changed completely by Westfield. And there's a lot more restaurants and a lot less brick-and-mortar stores.
And then you also see that in the Santa Anita Mall in Arcadia, which seems to be doing just fine.
And that was catering to a specific group of people. There are a lot of Asians in that marketplace, so they put in specific retail stores to cater to that population. And that has been very successful for them.
And what about for tourists? Do tourists come here to shop?
Tourists do come to shop there especially, and you have Santa Anita Racetrack, which is right there. So having the mall nearby is a great attraction for people, and it is fitting the need of a community.
Okay, so what about big stores like Macy's and Sears when they close their doors? As you say, that's a lot of retail space, square footage. What happens to that square footage? Who moves in?
They're going to have a problem getting people to move into that space. So I believe you're going to see a combination of housing and retail being in the same location. And we're seeing that now where malls are going to be changing because we're too many malls in this country. So maybe about 50% of the malls might just disappear.
50%?
Yeah, it's going to be a high percentage of malls are going to go just disappear.
And then you'll have apartments moving in there?
Yeah, I think you're seeing this, and we're seeing it now. You'll see apartment buildings being created on the upper floors, and the bottom floors will be retail. So it'll be a mixed usage, and you'll see more theaters coming to these local areas so that people can stay in their own neighborhoods.
So it's like a traditional city?
Correct. You see that much more back east. I see that in New York. I see it in Boston. A lot, and I think we're going to start seeing more of that in the Los Angeles area.
So we see it at the Americana. Is that successful? Do people live in those apartments?
Yes, and I think you're even seeing it in, you know, downtown Los Angeles is like a revitalized area. People want to live and shop in their neighborhood, and that's why from LA Live to all the streets in the downtown area are becoming young location, you know, young people go there, and you're seeing entertainment there. We're seeing live theater there. So it's a new environment for the millennial.
But what does this mean for people who work in retail? The New York Times recently reported that around 90,000 Americans have been laid off from these kinds of stores since October. And that's really a lot more than all the people employed by the coal industry, for example, you know, which the president talks a lot about. Is anyone talking about the plight of the retail worker?
I don't think we're hearing much about it at this point. I do know from my experience and working with retailers, there's going to be a lot more unemployment. Retailers are going to shrink their footprints, have smaller stores. One of the things you see in Europe is small retail stores where people come in and shop, but they don't take the product with them. It's delivered from a central warehouse the next day. So you don't need as much square footage, and therefore, less people need to work the store.
So where will those people go then? Where will they work?
Other industries they're going to have to seek out. And I don't have the answer for that, but they're not going to be in retail because retail will be, there'll be less retail in the next few years.
Ron Friedman is an LA-based retail expert with the accounting and advisory firm Markham. Ron, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Have a great day.
Thank you. And we want to hear from you. Have you recently been laid off from your retail job because your store closed? Share your story with us on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, a lot of tech startup culture feels like a parody. Well, now someone has written a real parody.
I just wanted to highlight how much a lot of startup culture is made for only for people in their 20s, and how it kind of leaves out a very large segment of the population.
BuzzFeed writer Dori Shafrir on her new novel, Startup, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The tech industry often does a pretty good job of parodying itself. Think about Uber CEO, an tech bro, Travis Kalanick, calling his company Boober because all the women he scored with his success from Uber. But because there's endless fun to be had skewering the tech industry, there's a new satire of startup culture out now. It's called, appropriately, Startup. In the novel, we meet a 28-year-old CEO who's come up with an app that figures out when people need to be cheered up. His company even has a motto, do good work and the work will help the good. Well, things go bad for him after he sexts one of his employees and a journalist sees the picture he has sent her. It's a picture of his anatomy. The author of the new novel is a journalist herself, Dori Shafrir. She's a culture writer with BuzzFeed. Hi.
Hi.
Okay. So first of all, has that ever happened to you where you've seen a picture, a sext that you shouldn't have?
It has not happened to me.
Okay.
It is, in fact, a work of fiction. that aspect of it is definitely fictional.
But believable.
Yes, all too believable. I think I'm probably like a few years too old for the true dick revolution.
Uh-huh.
Can we say that?
Say it.
Great. You know, I think that probably people in their 20s getting a dick these days is like...
It's no biggie.
It's no big deal.
Yeah.
So I figured that would seem realistic, that that was a thing that would happen.
Well, Anthony Weiner is older, so it's not just his generation.
Yes, that is true. Although he was sexting younger, much younger women.
Yes, that's true. So, okay, so let's talk about this fictional startup. It's called Takeoff.
Yes.
And it's run by this guy named Mac McAllister, which is just a great bro name.
Thank you.
Tell us more about his big idea.
Mac kind of thinks that he can optimize everything, including people's moods. So he thinks that by taking into account everything that you do on your phone, whether it's tweeting, texting, Facebook status update, liking a Facebook status update, he's going to take all that data and he's going to figure out when you might need to be cheered up and send you like a funny animated GIF or a text or whatever. And this is his big idea.
And people like it, right? These VCs love it. They want to give him
$600
million.
Yeah, when he pitches it to the VCs, he says, you know, imagine you need to get an Uber and it's pouring rain and you're really frustrated. And they're all like, yeah, totally. Like, he's speaking their language.
and then you're really frustrated and the app somehow senses that.
Yeah, and then you're like, oh, okay, I feel a little better. I'm calming down.
So this actually sounds like something that could happen in the real world, that this could be pitched as a serious app. A mindfulness app or something like that.
Yeah.
How did you get this idea?
I was just kind of thinking about what would a guy who genuinely believes that he is a force for good, what is the kind of app that he would want to put out in the world? He's already thinking in terms of his legacy. What are people going to think of Mac McAllister, you know, 50 years from now? He's the one who turned around how people kind of see themselves. So he has very grandiose notions of who he is and the effect that he can have on the world. And so I was kind of playing around with that.
Have you met real Mac McAllisters who are like this?
I think you kind of have to be that way to have this conviction that what you're doing is so important. Otherwise, like, why go on? It's so hard to start a company. It's so hard to raise money. If you're the founder of a company, you are working day and night, probably 7 days a week, especially in the beginning, to really get this company off the ground. And if you don't believe that this company is the best thing that has ever happened to everyone in the world, then you might not be able to go on. Hmm. So I think every startup founder has to have a little bit of narcissism, or more than a little bit.
A lot of bit of narcissism.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you do paint the picture of a culture that is, it's almost like a religion, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no beginning or end to it, that mm-hmm. you are immersed in it totally. So mm-hmm. you live at work and you work at home, and mm-hmm. sometimes the two are the same. Maybe you live with your coworkers, and yeah. it's like an extension of college life and dorm life.
Yes.
And so as someone who works at BuzzFeed and who sure. is in that world, mm-hmm. is that something that you have experienced and that perhaps it's not as welcoming to someone who's maybe a little bit older than 20-something?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely something I have observed. I think when you get hundreds of people in their 20s together for 8 to 14 hours a day, they're naturally going to start socializing
yes.
with each other.
And then some.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a lot of startups, not just BuzzFeed, kind of make that easy. Like, there's tons of snacks everywhere. You get free lunch all the time. There's, you know, there's reasons that you want to stay in the office and not ever leave. But I think that that sort of exacerbates the insularness of many startups.
Yeah. And then when something goes wrong, like sexual harassment, which is a key plot point in your book,
yes.
then those lines have already been crossed in so many other ways that perhaps people are confused by where they stand and how they should behave.
That is something that comes up in the book. Someone is not really sure if she has experienced sexual harassment. And in fact, doesn't want to see herself as a victim of sexual harassment, in part because she's never known a world where the way that she interacts with her boss and her coworkers is not this kind of boundary line crossing way.
So there's another character there. Her name is Sabrina Blum, and she's 36 years old. She has two kids, and she does not fit in with this culture at all.
No.
What does she represent to you?
I mean, I think she does represent this alienation that people who are just a few years older can really feel. I mean, she feels it especially because she was out of the workforce for a few years. She was home with her kids for a few years, and then she decides to go back to work. You know, she, I think, in the book also serves as like a way for me to get in some commentary about the world as seen through the eyes of an outsider, because she really is an outsider. So she has this very confused, but also she kind of wants to be accepted by this world, but she doesn't even know where to start. Like, she has to be home by 6 to relieve her nanny, whereas everyone else she works with is not only working late, but they're going out for drinks after work. So already that's something that she can't be a part of. And I just wanted to highlight how much a lot of startup culture is made for only for people in their 20s and how it kind of leaves out a very large segment of the population.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Dori Shafrir. She's written a new novel. It's called Startup, and it's about a startup. One of the characters in your book is a journalist. Her name is Katya, and
yes.
she works for like a tech crunch, is that?
It's called Tech Scene.
I know, but it's
yeah.
a... But,
so, it's a, yeah, it's similar.
Based on a tech
Inspired
crunch.
Inspired by.
But there's an interesting part in there, which I wonder if you can comment on in the real world. And that is, she's told that she's going to be rated more on clicks, rated less on clicks and more on engagement,
yes.
more on the impact that she has in
yes.
the real world. And she's kind of befuddled by this. And
yes.
she wonders, well, if people like my stuff and they click on it, then what's wrong with that?
Right. I should also say Katya's 24, and this is her first full-time job after college. And I think what we're seeing there in Katya's experience is the fact that in digital media, the goalposts are always shifting.
Hmm.
Like, one day it is traffic. It is important how many clicks and eyeballs your stories get. And, you know, one day your story gets hundreds of thousands of clicks and you're like, great. I'm riding high. I will never be fired. You know, I'm going to have this job forever. And then your boss is like, actually, we're changing the metric to, let's say, how long people spend on the page after they click on it. And you're like, oh, no. Like, suddenly your stock has tumbled. And so that, I think, is a very real thing that happens.
Has that happened to you?
Not in such a, I mean, I think, because my book is kind of more of a satire, the way that it happens to Katya is a bit exaggerated. Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, the places I've worked, you know, not just BuzzFeed, but other places, there's always strategy shifts. And there's just a million different ways that you can be evaluated.
So how does that change how you do your job or how you see journalism?
I mean, I think it makes people crazy.
Uh-huh.
Because there are some stories that people want to share more than others, for example. And so then all of a sudden, if that's what you're being evaluated on, you have to really kind of reorient yourself to this new metric that your bosses have suddenly decided is the important metric. I guess in some way, I do find it a little bit exciting, the changing of the metric, because it's almost like a puzzle every time it happens. It's like, okay, well, now I have to figure this out. But I'm also older and have been doing this for longer. And so it's not as scary to me as I think it would be to someone like Katya, who's 24, and this is all she's ever known. I'm sort of not cynical exactly, but it's just sort of par for the course for me at this point.
So there's a strong feminism point of view in your book. And of course, the action happens around this sex and the sexual harassment and all that. I don't think I'm giving too much away by talking about that. But do you see this from your particular perch as a particularly male dominated and therefore kind of myopic world?
Yes. I mean, the short answer is yes. I think that it is exacerbated by this attitude of, we're changing the world, we're disrupting things, we're, you know, we're breaking stuff, because that gives people, mostly men, cover to do things that would not be acceptable at a more traditional workplace. And a thing that I think you've also heard people say constantly, that I think they're starting to catch on that people aren't buying this as an excuse anymore, but people love to say it's a pipeline problem. There just aren't enough women to hire. We just hire the best people. We're not just going to hire a woman because she's a woman. We hire the best people. And that attitude, I think, has exacerbated the very macho culture of Silicon Valley.
So when you say pipeline problem, or when they say pipeline problem, it means it's not their problem. It's the fact that not enough women studied coding in high school or college or whatever.
Their excuse is that there aren't enough qualified women to even hire. So not our fault.
But then they're not hiring positions that have specific computer expertise and everything. I mean, not everyone's an engineer, right?
Right, exactly. So you do see women in what they call, quote, softer roles, like marketing and human resources. And those are kind of the stereotypically female roles in Silicon Valley. But that also means that you don't have female role models. You don't have female heads of engineering, and you don't have these women working in IT or, you know, programming. There's no one for women to feel like they're being mentored by. And, you know, it just kind of creates a whole host of problems.
So it's significant then in your book that it's three women who disrupt the system.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but I will say that the women in the book find that they have common ground. And I think that that is important for women in Silicon Valley or in, you know, Silicon Alley, wherever you may, you know, wherever you, Silicon Beach, wherever you may work, is that the women in these industries have learned that they need to stick together. And, you know, you do see that because there are not that many of them.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
That's Dori Shafrir. She's senior culture writer at BuzzFeed and author of the new novel Startup. Coming up on this program, Alex Jones of InfoWars. He has millions of followers for his out there beliefs. He has one in particular. That's the President of the United States. Well, Alex Jones is in a custody battle. His lawyer now This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, right-wing media superstar Bill O'Reilly is out at Fox News after multiple allegations of sexual harassment and settlements with former staffers. And elsewhere in the conservative media world, another personality is in trouble. Alex Jones is the man behind InfoWars, a show he broadcasts from his basement to 2 million YouTube subscribers. But a custody battle with his ex-wife is raising questions over whether or not the whole thing is an elaborate performance piece. And here to tell us more is Jack Holmes, associate editor at Esquire.com. Hi, Jack.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. Well, first, I want to give our listeners a little taste of Alex Jones and InfoWars, just in case they're unfamiliar.
They give the troops special vaccines that are really nanotech that already re-engineer their brains. What do you think tap water is? It's a gay bomb, baby. You think I am like, oh, shocked by it, so I'm up here bashing it because I don't like gay people? I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay. Serious crap.
Wow. Okay. Well, so that's him banging his fist on the table. What is that?
So this is sort of part of his larger persona of questioning authority and the official line at every turn. And sometimes that leads him into strange places, like thinking that fluoride in water is poison for people. But also sometimes in more sinister, less funny directions, like when he says 9/11 or the Sandy Hook school shooting were hoaxes perpetrated by the government. That's when it sort of has darker implications.
Right. And then and a lot of what he says sometimes ends up coming out of the mouth or the Twitter feed of the president, right?
Yeah. The president certainly is a bit more conspiracy-minded, you might say, than his predecessors. And he really latched on to Alex Jones during the election because Jones, in coordination with other figures and outlets on the right, was really a reliable source of conspiracy theories about Trump's opponent, Hillary Clinton, and was a reliable supporter of Trump from early on. And so Trump actually eventually made an appearance on the Alex Jones show. Trump confidant Roger Stone makes frequent appearances. So they've really sort of built a connection there.
Yeah, Trump said, your reputation is amazing. I will not let you down. He said that mm-hmm. to Alex Jones. So did he get a big boost from that and from the campaign?
I think he did. And it actually wasn't just Trump. I mean, Hillary Clinton made a pretty prominent speech about fake news and the conspiracy mongering on that side of the, you know, media ecosystem and mentioned Alex Jones by name. And for someone like him, it really helps what he's trying to do if the people at the highest echelons of the power structure are acknowledging him as this sort of heroic dissident, as that's how he would cast it to his viewers. So from both sides, really, he was boosted after the election.
And then he also has this vitamin empire, and he sells, what is he doing with that? He's selling something called Super Male Vitality.
Yeah, he has a whole line of supplements. There's Super Male Vitality. He has, you know, Brain Force Plus, which will supercharge your mind. He also sells these survivalist products, like a freeze dryer that will keep your food for 25 years in case of the apocalypse. And there's a great piece on Vice.com, actually, about how on air he actually spins these products into his narratives about, you know, a coming apocalypse or corporations or the government trying to poison you, and then he magically has a remedy. For instance, we talked about fluoride. He sells a variety of different filters on his website that filter out the fluoride from your water. So it's sort of a self-serving or a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So he's in this legal dispute with his ex-wife, who basically says that he is unstable and that the kids, I think three kids who were living with him, should live with her because they're being influenced by this madman. What? Tell us more about this lawsuit and what's going on.
So when they divorced, I think 3 years ago, Alex Jones actually got custody of the children. They kept living in the family home with him. But for a while now, his wife has been trying to get custody back of the kids. She has very limited visitation rights. But in this iteration of the dispute, she is really focusing on how his on-air personality is so, strange and kind of scary at times that she says that that's how he's like all the time, and so he is unfit to care for their children because of that. And the most fascinating part is that his lawyer's defense is that actually the character he plays on TV is just a character, that he's a performance artist, and that at home he never acts that way around the children. But for our purposes, it's interesting because basically his lawyers are saying that what he's saying is not what he believes when he's on air.
So how's that going over with his supporters?
So it's really unclear at the moment. He's released multiple videos since that was in the pretrial hearing where that explicit language is used. Since then, before and after subsequent hearings, he's been releasing videos on his website, on YouTube, basically giving these convoluted explanations of how he really is real, but that sometimes he's an actor, and it's almost, you know, it sort of folds in on itself at some point. But basically, he's caught in this bind where he either has to give up or, you know, cede this ground to his wife that maybe he's unfit to take care of the children, or he has to tell his listeners that what he's saying he doesn't actually believe.
Okay, well, let's play a clip of tape that illustrates what you just said.
There are headlines in BBC, Reuters, AP, InfoWars host, Alex Jones plays a character is different in real life. What? I didn't say that.
Okay, so he's there. He's sort of sure up his support with his followers.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a trial that's going on for, a couple of weeks in Austin?
Yes. And I guess the pretrial proceedings started at the end of last week, and then the trial started in earnest on Monday. And Alex Jones is actually going to take the stand and testify today.
Oh, well, that should be interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. So the news that Bill O'Reilly is out, and with that, is there something to be said about what's happening with the right-wing media landscape? How do InfoWars and shows like O'Reilly, The Factor, how do those shows kind of feed off each other or intersect?
Well, first of all, this defense mounted by Jones's lawyers really makes us ask the question, is there anyone else in this sort of ecosystem who is playing a character rather than espousing their true beliefs? But in terms of how the far right of InfoWars and Breitbart interacts with the slightly more moderate right of the O'Reilly factors, that they tend to be the genesis of some of the farther out there theories that eventually sort of get laundered into the mainstream by more moderate voices. So if Alex Jones were to say, for instance, that, as he did throughout the election, that Hillary Clinton was secretly ill with some illness, sometimes they said pneumonia, other whatever else they said, if Bill O'Reilly repeats that on his air with his larger listening base that is considered more mainstream, suddenly that approaches a more accepted part of the dialogue. And so that's sort of the feedback between the two of them. But there's definitely a significant amount of turmoil on the right in right-wing media right now because Breitbart, of course, has a major ally in Steve Bannon in the White House who is fading from prominence. Mm-hmm. And you see that reflected in their coverage of the Republican Party and the administration.
Yeah, and didn't Alex Jones coin, or at least was one of the first to coin fake news?
Well, he is considered one of the prime purveyors of it, certainly.
Okay.
I mean, fake news has obviously disputed sourcing,
right,
who came up with it.
It's fake news is fake news. Okay. Jack Holmes, associate editor at Esquire.com. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Wow, what a tangled web we weave, Jelly Myers.
I went to the InfoWars store just now just to look up what super male vitality is, because you mentioned that in there. And it is a supplement. They're having a sale on it today, Madeline. 25% off. It's $44.96 for
a
little dropper of super male vitality, which purports to do some pretty incredible things.
I am not going to talk about them on the radio, though. But
thank you.
John G. Hill today wanted to complain that that the biggest question of our time is why the Constitution seems so toothless. He's talking about Ivanka Trump and her role in the White House and being able to forward her business interests. He says Trump and his family are violating the Constitution every day by mixing their business with their politics, yet no one is doing anything about this, and there seems to be no indication that anyone will.
Okay, the emoluments clause. We all know what it is, but we don't know really what to do with it. Julie Myers, thank you very much. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. See you tomorrow.